But I appreciate the opportunity to be here because every day that I'm able to do this, I understand is something precious, and it could be the last time. So I really do appreciate it. This talk I'm going to give you around the world in 40 minutes is a foreign policy talk about what the United States government is doing around the world, and what that might mean for you and for your children and so forth. But the things that we've heard this morning are all part of this this same thing. It's part of a gigantic worldwide struggle that's going on right now by the forces of what some people might call the New World Order. That's what the first President Bush called it. You call it whatever you want to, but the United Nations divides it into three different categories. They say we're developed, we're rich countries, the United States, Western Europe, and the like. We're developed. Then they have a category they call developing countries. Those are the kind that have accepted the tenets of world government, but they're not quite there yet. They don't quite owe enough money to be totally developed. And then there's undeveloped countries who, you know, they're basically solvent. Once they become total debt slaves, then they're developed. But we'll look at this as we go along, and keep in mind as we go that it's all part of a plan, and I'm not talking about a conspiracy theory. I'm talking about the plan of power seekers around the world to seek power. I mean, it's simply what they do. It's something that they dream of, they work for, they lust for their entire lives to achieve it. And once they achieve it, they're going to use it against somebody. And it's usually the weak and helpless that they use it against. That's what power seekers and power holders do. And this is one reason why, from my perspective, I tell you this to tell you who and what I am so that you'll understand the things that I say in this talk. But I take the side of humanity against those who hold power. I take the side of people against the states of the world. As they build more and more power, we get weaker and weaker as they conduct their war against the human race, as I like to call it. It's all part of this gigantic network of people that are out there. So the world's a big place, and we only have 40 minutes, so let's get going. I thought that was supposed to be in color. Go back to the world for a second. This is the world, the political world as we know it today, and it is unfortunately run by lunatics and pathological criminals for the most part. And I'm saying that, well, as we journey around the world, hopefully you'll be able to see that. They all form a network, and the reason I say they're lunatics is sane people don't do what these people do. But once we have the whole world up there, basically the American military and foreign policy thrust right now is one of using the military and especially our Navy to control the various oil choke points of the world, which there are about six, and we can look at them. Keep in mind as we do this that this country is technically bankrupt, but it continues its efforts every day anyway. For example, most of this foreign policy strategy that we're going to see is conducted with carrier forces, U.S. nuclear supercarriers, like the George Washington that was just dispatched off the coast of Vietnam to conduct a joint exercise with the Vietnamese Navy. How much does it cost to keep the George Washington at sea? The answer is about $25 million per day, every day. That's why there may be a lot of carriers out there, but not many of them are at sea. They spend some time in port. How much does it cost to send the president on a 10-day visit to India, Indonesia, and Korea? $200 million per day, approximately. $2 billion, that's right. This is from a nation that is essentially, it's $14 trillion in debt, and that's a lot. We can go into that later, but let's go on and visit our friends in Europe. This is Europe, and as you've heard from the news recently, a lot of things are happening there, especially France, Germany, and the United Kingdom, or England. You've seen the pictures on TV of various riots, things of that nature, going on, especially in France, as people rebel against what the French calls their austerity program. This man in France who came up with this idea to change the structure of French retirement, you've heard it as, you know, retirement at age 60, and all these French people were ready to burn down their country because they wanted to move it to age 62. But there's more to it than that, as there is most things. These people are enraged at Sarkozy's government because of many things. And what they see is hypocrisy, basically. They see a country that says, we're broke and we can't pay the social contract that we have with you that's existed for decades. Essentially, it's a 40-year. It's not just age 60, it's the level of payout into the system that the French people make, and generally that's about 40 years. But the man who came up with the idea of extending the retirement age, he was just involved in a scandal where his position in the government was used by this lady who had inherited the L'Oreal fortune, you know, to steer clients into this relative's investment firm and things of that nature. They see all this hypocrisy. They see a country that guarantees $150 billion in bailouts to the French banking system. And they're thinking, well, what about the taxpayers? I mean, why is it just the bondholders who always get bailed out? Why do the taxpayers take the haircut and the bondholders just let their hair grow? So they see this, and it's more to them than it is to us, because this is a system that their entire lives have been based on. At the same time, I read where there was a person in France, they call it the Secretary of State of this or that. They're basically cabinet-level positions. This man who was elected Secretary of State in the Paris region spent his first couple of months in office. He spent 12,000 pounds, which is about, or euros rather, 12,000 euros, which is about $15,000, on Cuban cigars. One sympathizes, but still, he should use his own money for that. And the people see that, and they think, that's our money that he's doing that with. Well, the French and British have entered into a military alliance now where they're going to have a joint military force made up of British Royal Marines and SAS troops and the best troops in the French Army. It's going to be commanded by a French general at first, but it rotates, I think, every couple of years. And they're basically allying themselves to fight what's going to happen when Spain and Portugal and Greece and Italy and Ireland and all those currencies, those countries, start collapsing under the weight of all this debt. In Germany, as you probably read, Angela Merkel now says that multiculturalism doesn't work, she says. And the German people basically want to be German again. They haven't been German since World War II. They were a little bit ashamed of what it meant to be German coming out of World War II. But now the German people are starting to say, it's time for us to be German again. So the French and English always start to get a little nervous when Germans start talking about being German. But as we move across Europe and you see all these countries that used to be Soviet satellites in Eastern Europe, Romania especially, Joan and I have some experience in. But these countries have basically committed to NATO and have forces, even though minor, symbolic even. They're not symbolic to the people that are there in Afghanistan. I think Romania has like 800 troops in Afghanistan, and there are some U.S. forces that are permanently stationed in Romania now. And other places, you know, we occupied Germany in World War II, and we never left. We're still there. So I don't know that we have to worry so much about Russian tanks coming, swarming across the plains of Eastern Europe now. You know, maybe we could save a little money by bringing these people home, maybe. But just look at these economies in Greece, Italy, Portugal, Spain may be a slight exception. If you've traveled in those countries, you know that they're based on tourism and they're based on the sun. And the sun doesn't produce many cars or other things. There are no jobs there, in other words. And they still have the same social systems as these northern countries that have the manufacturing, Germany, France, and England. And so all these social services have to be paid for with something. And that something has been debt for the last few years. And as I said before, it's always the taxpayer who takes the haircut. The banks and their bondholders escape. Okay, this is, once again, we find these Soviet satellite countries. And this is one of the great oil choke points, the Bosphorus, from the Black Sea into the Mediterranean, that we're continually worried about and continually having forces to interdict. If you remember back in around August of 2008, when the trouble broke out in Georgia, and Georgia was invaded by some Russians with tanks and so forth, the United States sent ships into the Black Sea, which has always been kind of off limits, a Russian lake, if you will. But we sent some ships in to dock there to let the Russians know that we were still number one in the world. And some Israelis joined us there as well and sent their message. The Russians don't seem to mind it too much. I mean, the United States has a defense budget, if you count the wars, what it spends on the various wars that we're fighting is roughly $1 trillion. And I think the Russians' budget is like 30 million, or 30 billion rather. But as we move on, we're going to come to Mongolia. No one cares about Mongolia, I know. But it is one of those developing countries I was telling you about. Mongolia was a free country a few years ago, made up of a bunch of nomadic tribesmen. The other day I was watching a program on the National Geographic about animals that migrate, birds and animals in Africa and so forth, and it said these animals migrate to live and they live to migrate. Well, people in Mongolia were nomadic tribesmen. Even when the Khans led their cavalry charges and conquered all the way into to Europe, they were nomadic people, and they were nomadic because that's what they needed to live, to chase the weather around the country and for crops and so forth. But the Russians in 1921 came into Mongolia and started changing all that, moving the people into cities, destroying their religion. 30,000 Buddhist priests were massacred and their temples and so forth destroyed. People moved into the cities so they would have jobs in Soviet factories, and they could have debt like everyone else. So a few years later, the International Monetary Fund come along, and they saw all these Mongolians were really poor, and so they said, we have to loan them some money. So they came in and essentially bought their economy by making gigantic IMF loans to them, and now Mongolia is a developed country because the people are completely poor and on starvation, and they're debt slaves to the International Monetary Fund. So we can put them among the developed nations of the world. Now here, it's time to talk about China, which Howard did in his October newsletter, one of them anyway. He elaborated very well about Chinese military expansion and things like that. But think about this. In keeping with my presupposition I told you about, that I'm on the side of humanity and against the nation states. China has existed for some 5,000 years, but it's only been communist since about 1947, a relatively small amount of time. And it is expanding into the Pacific and threatening and putting pressure on our Pacific bases like Guam, which is why we're spending billions of dollars of debt to rebuild the Guam base. And Kadena and Okinawa, I mean, I've been to both of those bases in a different time. But Kadena's under pressure for a different reason now besides China. The Japanese are starting to get a little uppity and maybe want it back. But the United States is also putting pressure on China militarily for many different reasons that we can look at in a minute and in many different ways. The Cold War is back. So we can all kind of rejoice about that. We've missed it. I mean, we had the Soviet Union, and it came down, and all these Soviet satellite states broke apart, and it was on its knees. And we tried to bring it back. I mean, we gave it a lot of American taxpayer money. We went into to the Soviet Union and rebuilt their petroleum industry so they could once again be a player in this Cold War. But so far, it's more talk than anything else. But China is a real player that we can be terrified of. And while we're terrified, we can really work hard and pay our debts and do what the forces of the New World Order tell us to do. Send our children to serve in the military because China is a serious threat that we have to face. And I'm not saying the Chinese aren't a serious threat. I'm just saying I've heard it all before. This is where it gets good. Look at this. This is, I mean, what worse enemy do we have than Iran? I mean, some of the most horrible people in the world are Iranians, as you all know. And look at what Iran faces. Right here is Israel, this tiny little strip of land that has some 220 nuclear weapons that we know of. And over here you have Pakistan, another nuclear-armed country that the United States occupies. As far as we know, the only nuclear weapons in Afghanistan are American. I mean, look at this. Afghanistan is a landlocked country. And this line right here, going back in history a little bit, this line that separates it from Pakistan, that's called the Durand Line. And it was established by Henry Durand, the British Foreign Secretary, in 1893. Because at one point, see, this is another part of my theme, which is that these aren't real countries. Most of the world is simply lines drawn on a piece of paper. The people who live there don't respect or even recognize those lines because they're tribal. And all this colonial line drawing is now breaking down in a worldwide revolution. Afghanistan doesn't recognize this line. They still think Pakistan's part of Afghanistan because it has been for centuries. This used to be part of British India, all of it. And in 1839, the British went into Afghanistan. And the word Stan, by the way, I'm sure you all know, means land, land of the Afghans, land of the Paks, and so forth. So they went into the land of the Afghans, and there are many other tribes there, and they were soundly defeated. And so they left, but that wasn't enough for them. They tried it again in 1879, and they fought there for 10 years. And still, that wasn't enough either. So in around 1919, they again came into Afghanistan. But in 1893, they drew a line in this moonscape, Mr. Duran did, and he said, these are two separate countries now, and everybody has to respect them. This man that ran Afghanistan, one of the Khans, K-H-A-N, not C-O-N, but he said, okay, you know, we'll respect this line. If you'll stay on one side of it, we'll stay on the other. But people have been fighting there ever since. What are we fighting in Afghanistan for? I mean, war supposedly has some kind of honor in it. Where's the honor in this? I mean, really, what are our kids doing in Afghanistan? The commander-in-chief doesn't know. He admits it. He says it's necessary. That's all he tells us. It's necessary. This is one of the most horrible things that we've done, in my opinion. It's necessary, he says. I heard him make a speech the other day in Korea, where he is today. I think today's his last day. He referred to himself as the commander of chief and chief. It sent a cold chill down my spine just to hear him speak those words. Now, I'm not saying he's any more horrible than his predecessor, who is a self-confessed war criminal and a committer of crimes against humanity. But that's another thing, another story. The president was in India as well a couple of days ago, and I wrote an article about it. You can see it on my CP of Tennessee blog if you want to. When Allison gets back and has a few chances to rest up, maybe she'll put it on the national website. But he went to India for a reason. And who knows what that reason is. I'm sure there are many. But one probable reason is to try to bolster India in our Cold War against China, our currency war. We have to have allies to fight this Cold War. He promised the Indians that they would be made eventually a UN Security Council permanent member, which, if that happened, would give them veto status over any United States decisions. That's probably a long time in the future, but he wants to move them in that direction so that they'll be a bulwark against Canada. I mean, against China. Maybe Canada, too. Who knows? But the Indians liked that because they applauded him. And he and his wife danced and had a good time there and so forth. And back at home in America, 42 million people subsist on food stamps. Some 20 million of them are without jobs. 15 million people own homes that are worth less than what they owe on them, and they can't pay for them. 21 million children live below the poverty line. Let Them Eat Cake was the name of my my article. But while we're still here, go back for one second, John. While we're still here, this is the Strait of Hormuz, another oil choke point, and one of Iran's greatest weapons in this war of words between Iran and the United States and Israel. It is one reason why the Iranians are not as worried about being attacked with nuclear weapons as they should be, as they develop their own. But they could probably close this oil choke point, and 40% of all the oil in the world moves down through here. It would be a severe blow, not just to the United States, but to other Western economies as well. Here's the other one. Bahr al-Munjab, I think I'm pronouncing that right, right here, coming out of the Red Sea and into the Arabian Sea. On one side of this tiny little point is Yemen, where we have many, many troops right now, as do the British commando types, SAS, Royal Marines, and U.S. Military. And on the other side, we find Somalia, another wonderful country that nobody wants or cares about. It's just a pile of sand, as far as anybody can tell. But it's very, very important now. We deal with some Somali refugees in Memphis, political refugees who come trying to escape the warfare there. We're fighting in both these places, our own ground forces right now. And we also have air forces and carrier-based aircraft here because those two countries, we're told, are infested with terrorists. But the point is, both these and the Suez Canal as well, connecting the Red Sea and the Mediterranean, are oil checkpoints that have to be controlled and maintained. And through doing that, we can control China. Why? Because we can cut off their oil supply, which in a Cold War is pretty important, especially if it becomes hot. Okay. India, you know, one of the things that the president was apparently talking to the Indians about is the Indians are very ticked off about Pakistan, an ancient enemy that they fought since for centuries. The Pakistanis admit that terrorists cross their borders at will into India and do what they do. And the Indians are very tired of it. And so they wanted to talk to the president about trying to do something about this. So I'm sure they discussed that. Now, in the hotel that the president stayed in, the Taj Mahal, which he rented the entire hotel, by the way, all 800 rooms of it, that very hotel just a few months ago was the scene of a terrorist attack where 171 people were killed. There were two other hotels, but that was the primary one. He stayed there. If you remember, these people landed from offshore and went into these hotels and killed a bunch of people. You've probably read where, as it turns out, U.S. intelligence services followed this person who was apparently the leader of that group for 5 years before it happened. They tracked him. 5 times he went to India, apparently for surveillance. They watched him and knew about it all this time and said nothing. Why? Who knows? We're going backwards. But this is a good slide because it shows us the overall picture of the Middle East with Turkey, the Bosporus right here, the Suez, and these other oil choke points in relation to Iraq right there, where we just sacrificed almost 5,000 young people and God only knows how many Iraqis. Iran. This is interesting when you look at the map. You can see why Iran might be a little bit nervous. You've got Americans here and here, and Israelis over here in an American satellite country right here. So Ahmadinejad, I always like to listen to him because sometimes he sounds like a reasonable man when you listen to him. I've read the letters that he wrote to the president. I find that fascinating. He wrote a letter to George Bush asking him about what it meant to be a Christian. You can get all that on the Internet, And he said, Mr. President, you know, and he listed off several things that he felt like Bush had done. And he said, is this what it means to be a Christian? It sounded very reasonable, you know. But then when he goes to the United Nations a couple of months ago to the annual Security Council meeting, he said that that the General Assembly, I said Security Council, but it was actually the General Assembly meeting, the General Assembly should be empowered, he said. And essentially, he calls for the Security Council to be done away with and the General Assembly to be empowered equally across the board, all nations, no veto. And all these, quote, rich countries, these developed countries, would get what they deserved then. But so I wrote an article about that too, and I said that I had a different answer for what should be done with the General Assembly. That basically the president should tell them, you got 90 days to get out of town. You're welcome back as a tourist anytime. Because the United Nations, I'm running out of time. There's still so much world to go. Go ahead, John. I was going to tell you a story about the United Nations, but I don't have time. This is Indonesia. This is where the president just came from. And, well, he was, the New York Times said, the president goes back to the land that calls him Barry. That was the front page of the New York Times. He was there doing whatever he did there. But now he's in, Korea, in Seoul. But look, the president and the secretary of state were in the Far East discussing how they could bring all these countries together into kind of a Far Eastern NATO, if you will. Asian countries, Asian, A-S-E-A-N, that means Association of Southeast Asian Nations. There are 10 of them. Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, and many others. But this country right here, Vietnam, is near and dear to me. It's now a united country, Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City. And we fought these people off and on for 25 years. And we killed who knows how many of them, maybe millions. And they killed some 60,000 of us and wounded tens of thousands of others, many of them psychologically, that were never recovered. And right now, we're conducting, I mean, this minute as we speak, a joint military exercise with Vietnam consisting of the U.S. supercarrier, the George Washington, and its fleet of support ships, nuclear submarines, and so forth, and units of the Vietnamese military. What goes around comes around. I mean, I guess it's okay. I'm not saying we should be enemies for life. I'm just saying, what's it all mean in the totality of things, you know? They're the same people that they were then. I still say that it's a revolutionary force across the world. But at the same time, the Russians, our old Cold War enemy, just signed a deal. Medvedev went to Russia, went to Vietnam personally, and did this in Hanoi to build two nuclear plants for them to be online and open and operating by the year 2020, because Hanoi has a real problem with power. Their power's off a lot during the day. They don't have very good sources. Maybe that's because we bombed them like Curtis LeMay said back to the Stone Age. I don't know. But we never bombed those dikes and flooded their cities. So that's probably not it. But still, Vietnam, who we were once at war with, can have nuclear plants, but Iran can't. Now, the Russians are also building nuclear plants in Venezuela. Say that's okay. They're transporting their nuclear technology, which they got from us because the best nuclear scientists in the world are American. We build nuclear plants all over the world, France and Russia and many other places. Joan, what's next? This is Japan. You can't see it very well, unfortunately. This is where the president is right now, unless he's already on Air Force One and the other 40 aircraft that transported his party. Some of you may have passed through this country once or twice. I have. The Secretary of State was there, too. We're conducting military exercises with all these Southeast Asian countries right now, including South Korea, like with ground forces and naval forces. I suppose we're trying to send them a message. We're still here. We're still number one in the world. You can still rely on us, even though we're technically bankrupt. The Japanese, if you go back and you look at the history that has been released since the 60-year ban on World War II history, you find some really interesting things. And you can find, if you look carefully, that much of the decisions that were made at the end of World War II toward Japan were made as a result of United Nations efforts to form and to write its charter and so forth. Go and find the book Shadows of Hiroshima and read that. It's by a Japanese lady named Kai, K-A-I Bird, spelled B-I-R-D. It's just a short little book that's been made into a film in Japan now. It's the first time that the Japanese have started to say, maybe we got a raw deal out of all this. But look at that. I'm told that I don't have time to pursue it any further. But the Japanese are interested in having us out of their bases in Okinawa. See the American occupation of Japan ended in 1952, but it really didn't. We're still there. And so they're starting to say, it's time for you to go. Okay, this is our hemisphere. Brazil, one of the most important economic countries in the world, is now run by a communist revolutionary named Dilma Rousseff. She's like a bank robber, you know, one of those types from the old days, one of those real revolutionary. She's in charge of this country now. And by the way, that's the only country that refused to attend the G20 summit recently. She said no. Yeah, I mean, I would too. Here we find, I wanted to talk to you for a minute about Mexico, but this part of the Caribbean with Cuba, Nicaragua is one of the most important countries in the Western Hemisphere because they make the best cigars that exist outside of Cuba. But, you know, you can't buy, thanks to the embargo, it's illegal for an American to buy a Cuban cigar anywhere in the world. It's not illegal for other people to do it, but it is for Americans. And I've been trying to get permission to go to Cuba. Maybe some of you people that are connected could get that for me. But I called my Congress woman, Marsha Blackburn, represents my district, and I called her office, and of course, she being high and lifted up, like Congress people are, she wouldn't actually speak to me. But she had one of her assistants talk to me. And he explained what you have to do to go to Cuba, because Joan and I were in Miami the other day, and we noticed at the Miami airport they have a gate for Havana. They have a flight from Havana. And so I checked into it, and like half the people sitting there are like CIA people, waiting to interrogate people coming back from Cuba. Because you can't spend money there. The Congresswoman's office told me, you can go, but you can't spend money. And if you spend money, you'll be arrested. And if you stay more than one day, if you stay overnight, you're presumed to have spent money. So you have to get permission. Maybe the Constitution Party would send me on a mission to Cuba to interview the Castro brothers, because I would like to talk to Fidel before he dies. He's been making noise and basically begging us to lift the embargo, to let them become a developed country. Right now, he's begging for debt. He wants to be indebted. The country is starving. Perhaps it's time we accommodated him. Maybe it's time that this 50-year war ended. Now, Jonah, is there another Mexico slide? Or is that it? Oh, yeah, this is Mexico. And I'm going to close by telling you that this is one of the most dangerous spots on earth for the United States right now. I would put this almost on a level with Afghanistan for us, but for a different reason. Let me ask you this. Because 90% of the world's heroin is produced in Afghanistan, we know that. How many times have you seen pictures of a Marine patrol walking through these poppy fields in Afghanistan? I have many times. 90% of the world's heroin is produced there. Does that make Afghanistan a narco-terrorist state? Or is this heroin produced to fund the Taliban armies? They sell it to Europe and to us, and our addicts inject it into their bodies. But does that make them, do they exist for the purpose of producing heroin, or do they produce heroin to fund their revolution? Mexico, is it a narco-terrorist state because it's constantly at war with these drug cartels? You know, since 2007, 30,000 people have been killed in Mexico. I had a nice discussion with one of the young ladies here at the hotel the other day. We had lunch with her, and she's from Mexico, and I was asking her all these questions about, you know, is Mexico a narco-terrorist state, or is it simply in revolution? And my theory that I present to you today is that it's in revolution. And that speaks ill for us because, by the way, I apologize for constantly using the term us when I refer to the U.S. government, because the U.S. government really isn't us. It's Washington. But I slip up and say us because it's so easy. I mean, I should say Washington is always on the wrong side of the revolution, like they are here. But especially these provinces in the South are in a state of virtual warfare constantly. And it's, you know, drugs is a system of gaining money and supplying it, but it's not the purpose for it, not in my opinion. This is the American-Mexican border, and for many, many years, thousands of people have been walking across that border every day, and who knows how many of them. We go back to our cities here and here, and where I live in Memphis, and over here where Virgil lives in Virginia somewhere, and these cities are full of people who've come across the border. Who knows how many of them are not ordinary people looking to better their lives through work and being able to make a little money and live a decent life. How many of them are people who are basically criminals and revolutionaries and nuclear terrorists? Who knows, you know? But if this whole country explodes in revolution and millions of people, not thousands, start streaming across the border, it's not going to be a pretty picture. What should we do? What should a president do? Well, you know, we've got over 100,000 desert troops in Afghanistan that could be very necessary someday to control that situation. Who knows? But the war in Afghanistan is necessary, we've been told. So it continues. But the other and last oil choke point is right here in Panama. And as Howard will tell you, because he's been interested in Panama since, before I was born, probably, forever. But we don't seem as interested in that choke point as we do some of those over in the Middle East, because we've let the Chinese control both sides of it. But we do have nuclear carrier forces on both sides. You know, I don't know why we chose to do that. But we did. This brings me to the end of my story. I wish it could go on longer. I could stay up here all day and we could talk about different things, but I know that you want to eat. So I'll close by again thanking you for your time, your attention, and Maybe someday we can do this again.